has turned all of their power and all of their, you know, really their focus on people like myself instead of really focusing on real threats like COVID. COVID-19 really showed that now DHS, you know, instead of really focusing on what could be real threats to the homeland, ended up focusing on people like me. So I unpacked that history. We have released the force.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will link to your new podcast, Erica Andiola, Chief Advocacy Officer for ACES Action, her new podcast, Homeland Insecurity. And thanks so much to Ryan Devereaux of The Intercept. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
This is Erin Yankee, longtime programmer here at KBOO. On March 16th, due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO canceled all classes, meetings, and events, and closed the station to all volunteers and staff. We also canceled our spring membership drive. However, a generous, anonymous donor agreed to match every dollar listeners contribute, up to $20,000, by May 31st. If you're financially able at this time, we hope you'll contribute to KBOO now at kboo.fm/give. You can also mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The station is working hard to ensure the health and safety of our volunteers, staff, and community, and to provide the volunteer support needed during this time of physical distancing to ensure our eclectic, high-quality programming remains on air and online. Thank you for your support in making this happen. We really appreciate it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a prison in Oregon has become the source of the single largest outbreak of COVID-19 in the state. Police last night attacked people protesting the death of Minneapolis man George Floyd. And in international news, the United States is changing its policy toward the Free Territory of Hong Kong. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Wednesday afternoon, there are 4,038 confirmed or presumptive cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. Presumptive cases, of course, refers to people who have not tested positive but have COVID-19 symptoms and have had close contact with someone confirmed to have been infected with the virus. 148 people with the virus have died in the state. The Oregon Health Authority today reported 71 new presumptive positive cases of the virus. Officials have reported no new coronavirus-related deaths for the third day in a row. All of Oregon's counties except for Multnomah County have applied or entered phase one of the reopening process. In Washington state, there have been 20,181 cases, with 1,078 deaths. Nationally, nearly 1.7 million people have tested positive for the virus. At least 100,008 people have died in the United States. On average in the U.S., 1,400 people have died every single day in May from COVID-19. Globally, the pandemic has sickened more than 5.6 million people across at least 177 countries. At least 352,800 people have died of the virus worldwide. Over 140 people have tested positive in an Oregon prison, making it the location of the single largest outbreak in the state. Here's KBOO's Nat Moon with the story.
On Friday, the Oregon Department of Corrections said a total of 141 people at the Oregon State Penitentiary have tested positive for COVID-19. The prison has now become the source of the single largest known outbreak of the virus in the state of Oregon. The LeGrand Observer reported that four prisoners at this maximum security prison in Salem have been treated for the coronavirus at local hospitals, with one prisoner dying from coronavirus. Prisoner movements within the penitentiary have been restricted in an attempt to contain the spread of the coronavirus. As most prisons, however, this one wasn't designed to support the idea of distancing. As Dr. Christopher DiGiulio, the chief of medicine for the corrections department, said, hundreds of men live in very close quarters on multiple tiers. Many infected prisoners have been moved to Coffee Creek Correctional Institution in Wilsonville, where their infirmary is equipped with rooms that limit air circulation. But the rising number of cases has forced the agency to shift away from that practice. About 15% or 300 of the nearly 2,000 prisoners have been tested. 2 weeks ago, a class action lawsuit against Governor Kate Brown was filed on behalf of seven prisoners in the Oregon State Prison System. The lawsuit was also filed against the Department of Corrections and its director. The lawsuit asked a judge to issue a temporary order that would require the state to reduce the number of incarcerated prisoners in order to allow for better social distancing. Prisoners who ask for better social distancing are often sent to solitary confinement. The suit alleges that prisoners' rights are being violated because the state is indifferent to their health care. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Motels, which have been hit hard by the pandemic, could be the solution for Portland's response to coronavirus in the houseless community. City officials are now considering buying motels as a solution for houseless people in the coronavirus pandemic, according to the Oregonian. Two meetings on Tuesday indicated that purchasing cash-strapped motels rather than paying current prices for hotel rooms could be the next move for the city when it comes to providing safe shelter for its most vulnerable residents. The Joint Offices of Homeless Services proposed $50 million of federal aid be used to continue houseless shelter in hotels and motels in the city for the next year to 18 months. Already, the office has moved a few hundred beds to new locations in order to allow for social distancing, but those temporary shelters in community centers and the Oregon Convention Center are likely to be closed as the city begins reopening. At a virtual town hall, Portland City Commissioners balked at the large price tag. At a virtual town hall, Portland City Commissioners balked at the large price tag proposed. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty commented, quote, "If we're going to spend $40 million and have nothing at the end of it, there's something fundamentally wrong with our response. Instead of paying hotel owners for rooms, houseless activists and the Joint Office for Homeless Services advocate for buying the motels themselves, which could later be converted into affordable housing. While the City Housing Bureau has not put out an estimate of what that purchase may cost or what motels might be up for sale, the pandemic more broadly has clarified the idea that crowded mass shelters may not be the solution for temporary housing going forward. The city has already invested in single-room occupancy units, similar to motel rooms, that share bathrooms and kitchens. Other cities have made similar moves. King County in Washington State purchased an Econo Lodge shortly before Washington's first coronavirus death. The idea also has support within the houseless community. A Portland State University survey last week found that 53% of those surveyed would list a hotel or motel room as their top choice for temporary housing. A second heart transplant program has received approval to set up shop in Portland. Providence Health and Services got regulatory approval to begin its program in its Southwest Portland St. Vincent Medical Center, and 16 new intensive care beds have been added to the hospital capacity for the program. Providence announced its intentions to start a program when the rival program at OHSU faltered in 2018 when four heart transplant doctor suddenly walked off the job. The OHSU program has since resumed. Each year, the transplant program will be required to perform 10 such surgeries, though Dr. Dan Ozeron, the director of the Providence Heart Institute, hopes they may be able to do 20 or 30 per year. As to when the first Providence heart transplant may be, Ozeron told the Oregonian, quote, "We have nothing scheduled at this point, but you don't schedule things in this business. They come up as they come up." Locals in Yakima County, Washington, are fighting for representation that actually represents their community. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Latinos in a Washington state community are fighting for fairness in elections. In Yakima County, members of the county commission have remained white even as the Latino population has soared. Robin Engel with the immigrant rights group One America says it's allowing the board to ignore the concerns of the Latino community.
A very slight white majority in Yakima County is functionally able to win each of those three seats in virtually every election cycle. Only one, I believe, Latina candidate has ever won to serve a seat in the Yakima County Commission.
Commissioners are elected countywide. Engel says because the county is racially segregated, a district-based system would give the Latino population more representation. One America and four Latino voters say they'll sue the county if elections aren't changed by July 13th. Commission members have asked for an extension. They say they're concerned about these issues and want to work collaboratively with residents to fix them. Rogelio Montes is a community activist in Yakima who signed the letter to the county commission. He says the Latino community feels ignored, and not only because of the voting system. Commission meetings were changed to mornings, when many people are at work, and voting material and hearings aren't translated into Spanish. Montes feels the community has been discouraged from voting.
We want someone that will represent everyone and focus on the whole county and to take us part of their community, too.
If the county doesn't change its election voluntarily, Engel says One America will challenge it under the state's Washington Voting Rights Act, signed into law in 2018.
It's a tool where voters can challenge their local municipality's election system if they feel that their vote is being suppressed, and that challenge can have teeth.
Engel says her group is researching other localities where unfair election systems might also be challenged under the Washington Voting Rights Act. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
As thousands marched in Minneapolis streets last night to protest the police murder of George Floyd nearby, police responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and stun grenades. George Floyd was a 46-year-old African-American man who was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis on Monday after being handcuffed and pinned to the ground by the officer's knee. On Wednesday, the Minneapolis Police Department identified the four officers involved as Derek Chauvin, Thomas Lane, Toe Tao, and J. Alexander Quang. Vice reported that Chauvin, the man responsible for the murder of Floyd, was previously involved in use of force incidents. Shortly after the video of the fatal incident emerged and went viral, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey fired the four officers who were on the scene. Bridget Floyd, the victim's sister, said this morning that those officers, quote, should be in jail for murder. President Trump threatened Twitter, where some days he has posted over 100 tweets after the site added fact-check links to two of his recent posts. On two highly inaccurate tweets Trump made about mail-in voting yesterday, Twitter added links inviting users to, quote, get the facts about mail-in ballots. The company said its action was in keeping with its, quote, civic integrity policy, which bars users from, quote, manipulating or interfering in elections or other civic processes. Trump tweeted today, quote, Republicans feel that social media platforms totally silence conservatives' voices. We will strongly regulate or close them down before we can ever allow this to happen. In the past, Trump has made several threats about media censorship that he has never acted on. Also yesterday, Timothy Clausutis, whose wife Lori died while working for Joe Scarborough, formally asked Twitter to remove tweets by Trump that baselessly accused Scarborough, a frequent Trump critic, of murder. The U.S. State Department has announced it will end the 23-year-old policy of treating Hong Kong as autonomous for trade and economic purposes as China prepares to severely limit civil liberties in the territory. Bypassing Hong Kong's legislature, Beijing will impose a highly restrictive anti-sedition law on Hong Kong tomorrow, threatening freedoms granted its citizens under the, quote, one country, two systems policy. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, quote, "While the United States once hoped that free and prosperous Hong Kong would provide a model for authoritarian China, it is now clear that China is modeling Hong Kong after itself." The U.S.-China relationship has become severely strained over the last 3 years, largely through the Trump administration's changes in trade policy and recent accusations by officials in the United States of the Chinese government's responsibility in the coronavirus pandemic. Bonnie Glazer, the director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said, quote, "Ultimately, we could see capital flight. We could see U.S. business moving out of Hong Kong, expats leaving, and the end to Hong Kong as an international financial center as we know it. Police in Hong Kong fired pepper pellets into crowds and arrested 300 people protesting Beijing's tightening grip on the city. Coronavirus had taken some momentum from the protests that were prevalent in the latter half of 2019. Beijing says the new law is needed to combat the regular protesting that has overtaken the territory, but advocates for a more democratic society say the move is a clear violation of the city's political freedom and civil liberties. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the pandemic's impact on the conversation around rights of nature and protecting the environment. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 63. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with a high of 89. Today in history, rapper and animal rights activist Andre Benjamin, aka Andre 3000, was born. He is best known as one half of the hip-hop group Outkast. The quote of the day is from Andre Benjamin. He said, quote, "When I'm on my own, I'm sitting around twiddling my thumbs like, ah, I'll do it tomorrow. It's different. There's a certain kind of magic when you work with other people." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is having difficulty prioritizing his outrage.
What's more tragic, that a cop kneeled for 7 minutes on a handcuffed man's neck and killed him, or that people watched and recorded it without trying to step in? What's worse, that 75% of McDonald's female employees experience sexual harassment on the job, or that so many people still eat there mostly because it's all they can afford? Having Trump as president is terrible enough, but not being able to get him out of office, stop him from packing the courts with corporate judges, and from taking away laws that protect the environment, children, and workers, who a White House advisor sees as human capital stock, adds anger and frustration to the tragic mix. Avoiding the news and going out to garden or walking around to see what's growing is very positive, strengthening, and necessary. We may have no control over the news or spring, but we can spread the seeds of flourishing, let the sun of joy and compassion grow inside us and radiate out to the world. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Funds from the CARES Act will be used to help Little Shell build a healthcare facility in order to combat COVID-19 in their community. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Montana received federal recognition in December. The tribe does not have a land base or a healthcare facility. But as Sophia Stewart Rossi reports, leaders have plans for a health center.
After filling out a nationwide application from the Department of Treasury, the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians received $25 million from the CARES Act to address the impacts of COVID-19. Via Zoom, Chairman Gerald Gray of the Little Shell Tribe expresses they're starting from ground zero.
We were really excited because, you know, people need to understand that we have nothing in terms of healthcare, any kind of clinic, nothing to offer our membership.
As of now, the federal award needs to be spent by December 30th, which is 7 months away. With such a short turnaround, the Little Shell Tribe will spend it with oversight from tribal attorneys and an outside certified public accountant. Following the award guidelines, the tribe is planning to use the money to purchase or build an Indian Health Services urgent health care facility in the Great Falls, Montana area with a focus in telemedicine.
That's very important for us because our population's spread out, not only in Montana, but across the United States.
With a longer turnaround, the Little Shell Tribe will look into private investors to build a hospital in Great Falls, Montana. I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Announcement of a major change in the access route to the proposed Pebble Mine in the Bristol Bay region of Alaska has been met with resistance from tribal groups and other opponents. According to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the least environmentally damaging access to the mine site is a road along the northern end of Lake Iliamna. Previous plans called for a route that included crossing the lake by ferry. The Igiagig Village Council rejected the route. In a statement said the Army Corps continues to disregard village concerns and has failed in the trust responsibility to adequately consult with the tribe. Bristol Bay Native Corporation said the route change has not been vetted by the public and cooperating agencies. The Army Corps is expected to release its final environmental impact statement for the proposed copper, gold, and molybdenum mine as early as next month. Canada's Indigenous Services Minister says ceremonies will be allowed to continue amid COVID-19 restrictions. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the decision puts Ottawa at odds with at least one province.
Concerns were first raised about Indigenous ceremonies after Royal Canadian Mounted Police were deployed to a First Nation in Saskatchewan, where a Sundance ceremony was being held. RCMP say they received at least two reports of large public gatherings at First Nations in the province. But organizers at one Saskatchewan event said there were 35 people in attendance, and all were following safety protocols set by the chief and council, including social distancing. In Ottawa, Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller said historical federal bans on Indigenous ceremonies and potlatches were put in place in the late 1880s and lasted until the 1950s. And he called that banning of sacred ceremonies a dark stain on Canada's history.
I want to ensure everyone listening that even in the face of a historic pandemic, Canada must not and will not prohibit these important practices. Any decision to cancel or postpone these events is a decision that is solely at the discretion of the community's leadership.
At the same time, Miller said it's important to heed the public health measures that are in place to slow the spread of COVID-19. Regulations by the province of Saskatchewan limit gatherings to 10 people, and the province's premier, Scott Moe, says no one should be exempt from these health orders because no one is exempt from the virus. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Justice Department has dropped its insider trading probe of three U.S. senators over stock sales they made as the coronavirus outbreak spread, but will continue to investigate Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina. Those no longer being investigated are Republican Senators Kelly Loeffler of Georgia, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, and California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Authorities were investigating whether the three senators sold off large amounts of stock based on information gleaned from private briefings about the coronavirus, avoiding losses in the market crash that came soon after. A spokesperson for Loeffler said the dropped case confirmed she did nothing wrong and that the probe was, quote, a politically motivated attack shamelessly promoted by the fake news media and her political opponents. The FBI is still investigating Senator Burr, whose cell phone was seized as a part of the investigation, and who is more personally involved in his stock trades than the other three. A recent study has found a correlation between what cable news station you watch and how likely you are to follow stay-at-home orders. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
A study has found that viewership of Fox News correlates with reduced compliance with stay-at-home orders. The study, published by the National Bureau of Economic Research, found that a 1% increase in Fox viewership in a zip code, quote, reduces the propensity to stay at home by 8.9 percentage points compared to the pre-pandemic average. The study measured differences between Fox News and CNN because they are widely watched networks, and researchers found a, quote, statistically significant link between Fox viewership and noncompliance with state restrictions enacted in late March and early April. The researchers of the study say the findings are the result of the network's, quote, misleading attempts to downplay the threat posed by the virus in early March. The goal of the study was to examine the consequences of cable viewership and the role that media outlets like Fox News play in the reinforcement or following of public health recommendations. An unrelated study from the University of Chicago last month found that, quote, greater viewership of Hannity relative to Tucker Carlson tonight was strongly associated with a greater number of COVID-19 cases and deaths in the early stages of the pandemic. A poll conducted in March found that Fox News viewers were far more likely to believe the threat of the virus was exaggerated. According to Salon, Fox News has recently seen a marked decline in coronavirus coverage, especially in comparison to CNN. Salon's Roger Sullenberger wrote, quote, "In what is perhaps the most remarkable indicator, the network has dramatically cut airtime for medical experts on the White House Corona Task Force." Reporting for KABU, I'm Nat Moon.
Republican governors in Florida and Georgia are offering their home states as alternatives to North Carolina after President Trump expressed impatience about talks of a more limited Republican National Convention due to the pandemic. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's okay for political conventions to be political, but pandemic response cannot be.
That's North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper responding to President Donald Trump's suggestion that the Republican National Committee might be looking for a new convention site for August, unless Cooper guarantees Charlotte will allow thousands of people at a big event in the middle of a pandemic. The RNC signed contracts with the city over 2 years ago. Cooper, a Democrat, says his office and the RNC have discussed options for a more limited convention, but it's unclear what the public health situation will be 3 months from now. His priority is protecting his constituents.
These are the same kind of conversations that we're having with the Carolina Panthers, the Charlotte Hornets, other large arena owners. Everybody wants to get back into action soon.
Already, two Republican governors have offered up their home states as possible alternatives, both among the first to begin reopening businesses and public spaces. Here's Florida's Ron DeSantis.
Miami could do it, Orlando could do it, Tampa could do it, Jacksonville could do it. You may even have some other places that could do it.
In Florida, hundreds of thousands of newly enfranchised people with past felony convictions can now register to vote after a federal judge struck down a law requiring court fees to be paid before registering. District Court Judge Robert Henkel ruled that if the returning citizen can afford it, they must pay the restitution to victims or fines that are part of a sentence, but non-administrative court fees, including penalties, which can add up considerably. Julie Ebenstein is senior staff attorney with the ACLU Voting Rights Project.
Before, the state was putting the onus on individual voters to make these complicated factual and legal determinations, and the court basically said, no, you, the state, need to be able to tell people and to be able to tell them relatively quickly within 3 weeks whether they owe something or not and how much they owe.
Across the country, in California, the GOP and conservative group Judicial Watch filed separate lawsuits against Governor Gavin Newsom's recent executive order to send November ballots to all registered voters. Despite years of evidence showing mail-in ballots are safe, one lawsuit argues mail-in elections lead to voter fraud. The second suit claims it's an attempt to override current California election law, but James Schwab from the Secretary of State's office says it makes sense to use executive orders to ensure safety in a public health emergency.
We've used executive orders in the past for different emergencies. Both in 2017 and 2019, we had wildfires that affected local elections, and used executive order authority to provide flexibility for those counties.
Speaking of vote by mail, Twitter for the first time put a warning on two of President Trump's tweets for containing misleading content, urging voters to get the facts on mail-in voting. And former Vice President Joe Biden scored the endorsement of the AFL-CIO, an influential coalition of 55 unions representing more than 12 million workers. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Althea Billings. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, we'll hear Between the Covers. Tomorrow, David Naiman will be discussing Fernanda Melcher's book, recently translated into English, called Hurricane Season. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, and tomorrow they will be remembering beloved animator Bruce Bickford. All of these KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kabu.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Kai Hushka, who is with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We have heard recently that in the midst of this pandemic, one of the responses of the Trump administration is to cut regulations that the Environmental Protection Agency would normally be enforcing. Could you talk about what's being cut and what are the impacts of that?
Yeah, the decision which came out a few weeks back was basically about pulling back the Environmental Protection Agency, that's the federal part of the government, which is supposed to be overseeing activities that have environmental impacts. Which include things like monitoring activities that have a high likelihood of environmental damage. So whether it's the fossil fuel industry or the industrial agricultural industry, but the federal government has had people and staff and resources pointed towards making sure that corporate interests are basically following the rules. And the decision was to basically freeze that. So to leave corporations really to monitor themselves. So there's been a lot of talk and chatter out there amongst environmental groups about the impact of really letting, I suppose, the foxes to guard the hen house kind of situation here, and really the ramifications to the environment and public health because of that. So these environmental agencies that we've relied on to protect us, and though they may have staved off some increased damage, really are just about monitoring our own demise. And so if anything that we should be really looking into at this time with the decision to basically freeze lots of elements of the EPA is to say, are these agencies really doing what we thought they were doing in the first place or should have been doing? And if not, what can we do differently in how we actually establish environmental protections? And if we really start to think about that, we have to do pretty much a radical overhaul, because the system we have today is really not about environmental protections, about monitoring how fast and to what degree we can actually destroy the environment under the guise that somehow we're protecting it.
Mm. And, of course, these are considered externalities by our economic system, in that those producing the pollution don't then have to pay for the costs of the public health problems and the degradation of our environment, because those are not considered costs of doing business. One of the things that Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is pushing for is the Rights of Nature doctrine What is that? What does it look like? And how would that be implemented? How would it be different than what the EPA does?
No, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. That really goes to the heart of that deep overhaul. And part of that deep overhaul is really how systemically we look at ourselves as human populations, as economic systems, to our direct connection to the ecology that we're a part of. Rights of Nature is saying that if we don't actually honor those systems that sustain us in a manner that allows those systems to sustain themselves, we can see the writing on the wall. And that writing on the wall today, of course, is climate change, you know, global ecosystem collapse, even the elements of desertification, ocean acidification, you know, viruses, pandemics, all of that stuff is really traceable to our own activities. Rights of Nature is saying that if we don't actually protect, legally protect nature for nature's sake, we can see, and we are seeing what happens because of it. So instead of authorizing, as our current environmental laws do, the rate or the degree of environmental destruction, the consideration would be at the very front end on what we do as far as human activity is this going to affect nature's ability to exist, persist, naturally evolve, all the things that nature needs to do for our own benefit as well as nature's. And if not, well, those kinds of activities can't either start, or if they do happen, they would be in violation of nature's rights. So it's not a new concept in the sense of the world is concerned. It is very new in the sense of our own country having to kind of move into that legal reality. Other places have begun to do that and really put nature first and understand that our economic systems, our human communities need to be part of that, not destroy and dominate nature, but actually honor and protect it, and that we have to work within those natural boundaries and not exceed them.
What can states do in order to preserve or promote the rights of nature doctrine? I understand that in Pennsylvania recently, it was invoked in order to revoke a drilling permit. And here in Oregon, we've got the Jordan Cove fracking pipeline terminal that was recently approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission after having been disapproved at the state level. What can states do in response in order to actually invoke this rights of nature and prevent these types of fossil fuel infrastructure projects from moving forward in our states?
It's going to take people really standing up, organizing, and coming together for what they believe in and the values they believe in. And if you love and want to protect your place, you're going to have to move in a very different manner than the system currently says is quote-unquote allowable. So places like Grant Township, even places like Lincoln County and Oregon have stood up for what they believed in, which is to say we have a right to clean air and clean water, natural ecosystems, rivers, watersheds have a right to exist and be unpolluted. And what they've done is asserted that through lawmaking. So they have passed local laws that really do two things. One, put forward the new notion of what the legal structure needs to look like in protecting nature's rights, but simultaneously challenging higher levels of law. So challenging state law that says, well, you can't protect yourselves at a better level than we say is allowable, even though what states are often doing is not really protecting the environment. They're allowing that corporate activity to move forward that destroys that environment that people in counties or communities are trying to protect. So there's a direct challenge, a resistance to really unjust law. So it's not so different than civil rights movements when they've had to challenge unjust law. People are doing it now from an environmental perspective. And through that, you begin to see momentum building, as in Grant Township, whether it's through legal breakthroughs or at least legal validation, but more importantly, the recognition that we have an upside-down system that has disempowered communities from protecting themselves, and Rights of Nature has become this vehicle of which communities are standing up for themselves, pushing back against unjust state and federal law as a means to begin to try to change that structure. And you're starting to see some movement that eventually could mean changing constitutional structures at the state or federal level.
Just for our listeners, if you could detail a little more about what exactly happened in Grant Township and why it's so significant.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. It's a sad one, a hopeful one. an ever-changing one in the sense of their saga. You know, it's 5 years in the making. You have a tiny little, you know, 600-700 person community who was basically targeted for toxic industrial waste. So waste product coming in from the hydraulic fracturing industry, which is, you know, the process for a pretty pervasive process now to pull up natural gas. There's a byproduct that's toxic, and they have to find places to get rid of it. So they basically target places where there are dried up drill wells and then inject this toxic waste into the ground with really no concept of the impact it's going to have environmentally and on public health. And this community said, no, we don't want it. All the while the state was saying it's fine. And so they passed a law saying we don't want this under our ability to protect our rights and to make these kind of decisions and protect the ecosystems as part of our own communities, not just the humans, but the non-human species. And as happens in these kind of cases, you had the fossil fuel industry suing them to say, no, our ability to basically poison your community is greater than your ability to protect it. And then, interestingly enough, the state regulatory agency stepped in and also sued the community saying, hey, you can't do this. We think it's fine, and you're going to get the toxic waste whether you want it or not. And the most recent thing that you mentioned was the state basically backing down, saying, well, we're going to revoke the permits now because there looks to be some possibility that the communities actually can have a higher standard. And we don't know what's going to happen here, but we're going to pull these permits and this and stop the fossil fuel company from dumping the toxic waste. And rightfully so, capitulate to the community who's saying we want a higher standard of protection, and you, the state, must honor that. It's a pretty shocking change of course, and whether it holds or not will is yet to be seen. But this idea that communities need more recognized power to protect themselves is not a new thing, and it really ranges across a broad spectrum of issues, whether it's, you know, gentrification of neighborhoods, whether it's more, you know, classic environmental issues, whether it's labor issues. We're all been handcuffed at the community level instead of actually being freed and liberated from making the real critical decisions. And it's really come from corporate powers, but corporate powers manipulating state and federal government to come crashing down on us. So the resistance, the effort to make laws they did in Grant Township to say, no, we don't want this, and really stand up to what they believe in, and run, you know, go the distance, is really a pretty amazing story, and hopefully an inspirational one for communities everywhere to do the same, because we all have our issues and we're all facing a very similar structure that is coming, you know, decisions coming from the top down, or as we started out our conversation here, the so-called agencies that are protecting us making decisions that, well, we're no longer going to, you know, send out people to monitor the damage that's being caused. And so you're kind of on your own, I think is actually a great opportunity for communities, whether it's smaller ones or even larger cities, to really, really take the reins and say, no, we clearly need more power to protect ourselves, to evolve ourselves. And there's been a massive failure systemically induced, really, at the state and federal level. And it's time we have a different paradigm here.
Do you feel like the movement at Standing Rock over a year ago now was sort of an impetus nationally for people standing up and saying we are protectors of the water, which was the standpoint that people took at Standing Rock, and was an indigenous-led movement? I mean, is that the kind of leadership that you're talking about to challenge these regulatory agencies at the state and federal level?
Yes, I think it's a fantastic example of the power of community, the power of resistance, the power of truth, the power to protect, the pulling out of the realization that we have a system that largely doesn't care about life. We have to take that energy that a Standing Rock put out and absorb that in the communities where we're at. And then we have to take it further. And in simple terms, we have to rewrite the rules. Because what had happened in Standing Rock was happening on the Big Island with Mauna Kea there and the indigenous-led effort of the people of Hawaii and so many other places, whether it's indigenous or non-indigenous communities. as we have rules that are really written to eliminate our ability to have a voice. And so the first step is to actually call that out. The next step should be to actually change those rules for the sake of our own existence, really. So we need growing mentalities of not just resisting and pushing back and hopefully stopping the worst of the harms as quickly as possible, but also understanding that we have to script the different reality for ourselves. And if we're going to come together under forms of government, that really means rewriting some basic tenets of how government is going to work and how decisions are going to be made, because the way that it sits today, that there's really a small number of entities and individuals that dictate our own reality. And unfortunately, that reality is pretty bleak. And now is a time, especially in the situation we're in, to really think about that, saying, do we really want that? And if not, well, let's take that energy from a Standing Rock and basically impose Standing Rock type values and energy in the places we're at pretty much every day until those rules really are rewritten and we can actually have the beginnings of an existence that we deserve to have, whether it's people or the planet itself.
Yeah, and of course, people are the planet. We're all a part of one ecosystem, so we can't live without it. I want to thank you for joining us today. Again, I've been speaking with Kai Huschke, who is with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Their website is celdf.org. I know they've got some webinars, some organizing going on, so that website, again, is celdf.org. Thank you, Kai, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thanks for giving me the time. Really appreciate it.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News In Depth.